After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
You know, as a symphony, even if you step up to do Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, it'll never be performed the same way twice. Never. You know, there's millions and infinitesimal little things that are going on with all the human beings playing it, you know.
Wow.
So when you're, you know, I mean, you can listen to a recording, yeah. But when you go hear it live, it'll never be, ever be the same thing. It's human beings that are bringing it all together, and it's all happening in an interactive, wonderful, magical way.
You know, that's one of the best definitions of impermanence, which we struggle to explain that. But what people have misunderstood, I think, about impermanence is, oh, it's just a nullifying and a void and nothing, you know, nothing exists. So, you know, and also emptiness. But what we're saying is there's this rich symphony going on, mm-hmm. and there is a pattern to it, but it'll never be the same from one time to one time. And that's true of every moment of your life.
Yeah.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist, coming to you with a bit of a scratchy throat today. So please bear with me. It's going to be kind of a sultry intro, and I'll try and keep it concise. On behalf of all of us here at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon, we sincerely hope this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are grateful that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guide David Nichtern discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And for this episode, we are very fortunate to have Sean Callery, an amazing composer and musician who primarily works in the medium of television and some film. And what a joy it is to present this episode with David and Sean, who go back to their days meeting in L.A. when they worked for New England Digital, the company that created the very important early digital sampling keyboard called the Synclavier. If you go to the show notes at the Be Here Now page for this podcast, we'll leave a link of David on the Merv Griffin Show in 1985 demonstrating the technology. It's a fun little clip. Beyond connecting around music, clearly they also connected around meditation and Buddhism and have maintained a beautiful connection together that is on display in this podcast, where they have a wide-ranging conversation around music, egolessness, shunyata, understanding suffering on the relative level and not bypassing, and music is a window to all these things. Couple things to pitch before we get in there that are important for you to know about. If you like this podcast and are interested in working with David directly in a workshop around your quote-unquote life puzzle. We've got some great news. David is giving a creativity, spirituality, and making a buck workshop at the New York Insight Center Thursday, June 15th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern, and that is in the year 2023, and it's also on Zoom. So it's not in person. So if you feel stuck in any of the three areas of creativity, practice, or livelihood, or could benefit from an exploration of the underlying principles that can lead to greater integration and harmony in your life, join us for this workshop. And you can find it at the website of our partner organization, New York Insight, which is nyimc.org, and click on the calendar. Speaking of Dharma Moon, we would all like to invite you to our 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training info session that is upcoming. And the date is Tuesday, June 6, 2023, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. And we have very special guest and Buddhist scholar, Professor Robert Thurman, joining us. So that's going to be really good. That's on Zoom. And we encourage you to check it out, especially if you are interested in our mindfulness teacher training program. You can do the whole 100 hours or just sign up for the first weekend and deepen your own practice. Again, that's June 16th, 2023 on Zoom, and head over to dharmamoon.com to check it out. Okay, I'll plug the Be Here Now stuff at the end. So a little more about Sean. He's an Emmy Award winning composer. He's received 17 Emmy nominations and 4 wins. You can hear his recent work on the TV series Walker, which just wrapped, as well as on the series Accused on Fox, which just got renewed for a second season. And now we are arriving to the final portion of this open monologue of epic proportions. While we were sheltering in place during the early days of the COVID pandemic, David took on a contemporary form of bodhisattva activity called the Nuji Challenge. And he gave his phone number to his students and many people and encouraged them to text him for 30 consecutive days after they had practiced mindfulness meditation. Sean made a bunch of amazing videos for each of his sits, and we'll be sharing several of those on the YouTube version of this podcast. So check it out. Okay, this concludes the opening remarks. It is now my pleasure and privilege to share with you Episode 42 of the CSM Podcast, Composing Dharma with Sean Callery.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast, based on my book by the same name, which you can check out. But our basic premise is to talk to people who are interested in integrating those three strands in their actual life, which is creative expression, spiritual development, and some kind of relationship to livelihood. And, you know, we talk about defining success on our own terms using that blend. So, Sean, why don't we start with you? This is my guest tonight is Sean Callery, who is a very old friend. Why don't we start with how we met? Because it's kind of intriguing in a way that we still have our friendship in our different areas of working on things together. But how did we meet?
We met. You were wearing sunglasses at night, actually. No, I'm just kidding. We met in 1988. I had just moved to Los Angeles, and I was working for one of the first music companies that was making digital samplers and, you know, synthesis, the things that are in our phones now, you know, that we take for granted. They used to be these big 6-foot tall boxes, and you worked for that company. And I became sort of a product support person. And I think you had just left the company, but you were trying to, you know, hand off what you knew to the new incoming people. And I was one of them. And we did a couple trade shows together in Las Vegas, and I didn't know very much about you. Except that you were a composer and that you wrote, you know, I know that you wrote Midnight at the Oasis. And I also saw that you also around that time did that movie with Kevin Bacon, The Big Picture, which was also really funny. It was a great movie. And then Eric and I, we have another friend, Eric Gray, and we were trying to figure out when we were invited to visit the meditation center on 3rd Street in Los Angeles. I just can't remember how it came about, but I know that you somehow planted the seed hey, if you want to check something out, come here and talk. And the both of us were complete babes in the woods in terms of this kind of meditation study. And we went, and here we are chatting.
You know, 30 years later,
33 years later, I'm still calling you with the same questions, you know.
Well, you know, what's interesting about our relationship is completely organic. You know, our friendship is completely organic, but it does span both the creative field that we both work in, and mm-hmm. also the meditation. You've taken the Dharma Moon meditation teacher training program, and you're also helping people with their practice now.
Yes.
You have your own practice.
Yes.
We'll talk more about all that. And you are, just for everybody out there, you're the kind of talent in the entertainment world that not everybody knows by name and by face, but who's had a major, major role in terms of creating the content that people soak up on their TV screen. You're really a top, top shelf TV and film composer at this point.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, you knew me before I had any jobs doing this. You knew me as a person who was interested in doing this. And that's why I went to go work for Synclavier. That was the name of the company. And I had that vision for wanting to get into the industry in any way, shape, or form composing. And I've been really lucky. I'd even say, word I'd use is blessed, to be working with the people I got to work with on shows that actually went a certain amount of time. Like the first biggest show was the Kiefer Sutherland drama 24. That went for 8 years in 2001. And that was when I was really just, you know, not knowing exactly what I was doing, but I was doing it. And I did shows like Homeland, Jessica Jones, a Sherlock Holmes show called Elementary. You know,
was 24 your first gig scoring television?
No, the first one was a remake of a French film called La Femme Nikita, which was on the USA Network.
Yeah,
And that was actually a great show. It went for 4 years, and it was on the USA Network, which at the time was like, you know, wrestling. They had wrestling shows, and it was a very young network. You know, it's like wrestling, and then they started doing drama. You know, and then shows like Monk came along, and all these, you know, all this programming started happening. But Nikita was a really rare moment where I was brought into a situation that I was able to prosper in. And the show lasted for 4 years, and I got a real education doing that.
Yeah. And 24 and Homeland, these are, you know, absolutely, you have had your music heard in the mainstream television and film world. So people are aware of you, whether they're aware of being aware of you or not.
And even smaller shows, like there's some law dramas that I worked on that, you know, have a very minimal score, like Bull was on last year, and and now I'm working on a Western on the CW called Walker Independence. I'd never worked on a Western before.
Wow.
And that turned out to be a lot of fun. I knew it would be fun to explore that kind of genre. But, you know, CW shows, you know, they have beautiful people in the Old West in the 1800s with, you know, perfect teeth and, you know, just beautiful. You know, everybody's healthy and it's all diverse. And, but the people working on it are just smart people. Every now and again, when you're with people, you know, I think about the word Sangha a lot, because when you're with a really great group, when you're with a group that inspires you, I would say without a doubt my skill set as a composer was catapulted by being around people who are really good at what they did.
Oh, that's interesting. It's a highly collaborative field, right?
Yes.
You don't just get to go off and write your music and go like, hey, this is the way it goes.
If you do, I generally don't find those shows to last very long, honestly. Uh-huh. I mean, they can right. once the show airlifts, you can do it, but finding the sound and all that kind of stuff is really where the rubber meets the road in terms of heart and honesty and authenticity. What are we trying to tell? What are we trying to say? There's a lot of embarrassment that sometimes comes with a person when they don't exactly know how to react to something. You know, when they're hearing something and they feel something they want to convey to you, but they don't know how to convey. And then there's some tightening that you can sometimes feel. So this has been a real, it's an ongoing process in terms of that. But I love the collaboration process of putting music to picture. That's been a dream of mine. So
beautiful. And you know, a mutual friend of ours, Lee Holdridge, in the same arena, who I worked with on a couple of daytime TV shows, great composer and a great conductor. He would write on the blackboard for his clients: 1, fast; 2, cheap; 3, good. And he'd say, pick 2.
Right.
Have you found yourself in that situation?
Yes. I mean, there's, from a creative point of view, this is for me as an artist, if you know, I would say deadlines is probably been the best thing that ever happened to me. Because if you have something due that has to be delivered, sometimes you're really feeling if you're feeling some anxiety at the beginning of the process because you don't know how to find or thread the needle of something you're trying to solve. Sometimes I will sort of fantasize about the day after the due date, because you do know that you're not going to deliver. You do know that you're going to deliver, because not delivering is sort of a suicide of sorts. And so you know that that's not going to happen. So you can sometimes think, well, it will get done. I'm looking over there at me having finished it, but I still have work to do at this end. But those are the little parlor tricks you play. Fast by Thursday, you know, stay calm.
Well, and what I want to talk to you is, I want to talk to you about everything, because we run the gamut from, through the CSM topics to food and hanging out and all kinds of things.
And we went for long periods without, not communicating, but went for long periods where we weren't in contact. But then when we got together again, it's just like, you know, plugged right back in, you know?
Yeah. So you not only scored very notable TV shows, but you've won a bunch of Emmys for doing so. We could just get that out of the way. How many Emmys did you win?
4. I was nominated 17 times over the last 25 years.
Okay.
And yes, as a matter of fact, when we take meetings in Zoom, you know, the piano, I got a piano last year, and then they're back there in the view, but sometimes people give me crap for displaying them. I don't know if you can see them, but like sometimes I do this or do that. But they're back there. And I got 3 of them were for writing the underscore for 24, which was really unusual just from the point of view of the show was on for 8 years and, you know, and then one was for Jessica Jones. I wrote a main title theme for Jessica Jones, which was a Marvel Netflix show. But now there's such you cannot fathom the amount of television viewing that exists on a weekly basis.
Right.
So the ability to notice a show or the ability to tune into a show is really something that you have to curate now. It's not like there used to be kind of a collective Monday morning. Hey, did you see Hill Street Blues or did you watch Friends? And now it's, did you see The Watcher? Did you watch, Last Tango in Halifax, you know, there's so many lanes now, you know, and a lot of great music, by the way, a lot of great music.
We have people tuning in and watching, and they might watch one episode where I'm talking to a, you know, well-known Buddhist teacher, and then one where I'm talking to a creative or an entrepreneur. So you might go, well, like, wait a minute, what's holding this whole, podcast together? And it is the integration of elements that we're taking a leap out there and saying the integration of these three elements is important. And we even say at Dharma Moon, they have equal weight: creativity, spirituality, and livelihood. So I think that's a kind of certain perspective that we're sharing with people. And a lot of people resonate with it once they understand the premise. So, and it has something to do with your notion of success as a human being. And I don't mean it in a crass way. We're pretty clear about that. You know, somebody, in my view, is not necessarily successful just because they've banked a lot of money. Our culture obviously rewards you big time for that, or even had a lot of recognition. So how would you define success for you at this time in your life? when could you say, I feel I've succeeded with my aspiration to what?
Wow. Oh, well.
It's a big one.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say this, you know, your book, you know, you kind of, if in my view, sort of coalesced the energy that was sort of being manifested by successful people, in my view. You codified it in a way. Cause I think those three things, when I was trying to get hired or when I was working, I was happy. My level of happiness was kind of related to, yes, I had an aspiration to want to get into this. And when I was working towards that with exertion and with some sort of effort, there were setbacks and so forth and things of that nature. But I did appreciate that every time I was in a job, for example, I did sound effects editing for Star Trek, Deep Space Nine. I learned how to cut sound effects and you're thinking, well, what does that have to do with music and composing? Well, it quite a bit actually, because you're learning mm-hmm. how music and sound effects have to work together. So there's a connection that you have to, I guess, you know, from the point of view of path and where you're endeavoring to go, when you feel a connection towards that or heading towards that, you feel a bit of, there's a fundamentally good feeling about that journey part, even when it's sometimes difficult or when it's set back, but remaining with it is, and there's luck. I mean, I don't know how you talk about luck, but I met some interesting people that gave me opportunities. I met you. Mm-hmm. And then while I was working for Synclavier, I met Mark Snow, who did the X-Files. He recognized mm-hmm. some talent in me and he gave me some opportunities. But the thing that you asked me about happiness, you know, the thing that makes me fundamentally.
Well, no, I asked you about success.
Success, excuse me. I'm sorry. Success.
No, but we'll get to happiness too, because that's a good topic too. But well, just defining your notion of, you know, aspiration. And then, you know, fruition, you know, we talk about ground, path, and fruition in the Buddhist way.
Yeah.
So what would fruition look like for you?
Well,
this life.
I'm going to answer in a very relative sense at the moment. I had to write a scene where a woman had lost her husband in a shootout. And she's found in the middle of an open field in Santa Fe. It's supposed to, you know, doubling as Texas. And there's a moment that has to be treated delicately and musically. You want to bring an authentic moment to that part of the storytelling. And when you do it, it's a kind of a back and forth process of finding how it's going to quite make it, if it's working. But then there's a moment where it is sort of connecting and you're feeling it there. You know, you're feeling it's cohesion mm-hmm. and it's a bit of black magic for me. You know, it's like, how does it arrive? How do you get there? There's some sort of care and some sort of attention and there's some sort of relationship that's forming and there's an openness that's happening. And then when that starts to happen, that feels to me like a success. That is a success for me. Cause you're like that scene. If at the end of the day, I can say, I do like the way that scene came out. And then you have to shake the Etch-A-Sketch and it's all over because it's you're going on to something else. But the success is for me from the relative sense is the ongoing connecting. Now, I will not lie that being nominated for your peers is for awards is extraordinarily gratifying. It does make you feel very there's some out there work. There's some measurements out there in the world that say, hey, you've done some, this is some good work. That does feel good.
So connecting, being acknowledged, I'm putting together your package of fruition, your bundle.
Yes, connecting and acknowledgement. Yes, acknowledgement. Yes, acknowledgement has to be a part of it because you can't just function in the world without someone having feedback for you. Otherwise, you're not, I don't know if you're working. You know, most of the music I write has to be approved by people. Mm-hmm. And they have strong things too. So there's a kind of there's a kind of holding. I would say holding your seat, holding your seat with what you're doing. There's an authenticness to applying what you're doing. And I believe at an existential level that gets baked into my scores. I really do. I think if you watch something like I listened to music from a kid the other day who sent me a demo reel. And I said to him, I said, are you having as much fun composing this hearing it? Because I really thought I was hearing a lot of joy in that mm-hmm. person. Does that make sense? You know, it's sort of, so yeah. I guess,
I'm taking some notes on this because it's connecting, acknowledging authenticity.
Yep. And view. There's a view. You're making when you're composing, you're taking a, there's a specificity to your view when you're mm-hmm. composing something. You just can't go out there and say, well, I'm just going to write, you know, are you writing it through the eyes of this person? I mean, there's no level to how, there's more difficult scenes I've had to score where I don't even know how to put myself in the eyes of a person who's suffering, you know, in that way, you know, and you just like, wow, how can I even bring a musical sound to that moment that you've never experienced, that you've never had? Like I scored I had to score something a couple months ago. A woman comes back from being sexually assaulted and she's in her apartment. She's in her apartment by herself. Well, you know,
You have to experience what that would feel like.
You have to, it's almost like a Tong Lin kind of thing, bringing in the suffering of others, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would say, I actually made the case. I said, don't score it. I said, don't put any music to it. I said, just let it. It doesn't. There are certain things I think dramatically don't need any music. You know, if that, you know mm-hmm. what I mean. They're strong enough on their own. And that's, to quote you, David, skillful means. That's having the ability. That's the ability of looking at something and saying, "Hey."
And that's me quoting the previous people, by the way.
Exactly, but yeah. I hear you say it to me all the time, which is right. it's having sort of a confidence that grows to say, "I don't think we need this music moment here." Yeah. And but if I was younger, I'd be like, "Of course, I want this music moment. I want to make this the most meaningful thing in the world." But then you get a little bit more. You develop a bit more situational awareness and a little bit, I think you get a little wiser. I mean, mm-hmm. that's one thing that, so I've thrown out about 100,000 things that sort of, we're talking about success, but I'm relating them right now to the real, to the craft of what I do and the way I feel when I'm doing it right. You know, when I'm doing it in a way that makes sense to me.
And as a metaphor for your whole life, mm-hmm. Here's what I got so far and connecting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Acknowledgement.
Yep.
Authenticity.
Yes.
Unique view and committing to a perspective.
Yeah.
Empathy.
Yes. Absolutely.
And leaving space.
And oh man, can you send that to me? Because if I just said those six words, this podcast would be over in about 15 minutes. But that's true. That's sort of it. It's funny. The only word I really contemplate is acknowledgement, because acknowledgement for me is a bit of, well, you know, acknowledgement feels good. And there are stories all over the world about, well, it's a seductive thing. You like attention for your work. And I find it to be so extraordinarily important that remain a lowercase acknowledgement rather than the AAA acknowledgement in a way. But that's maybe my head trip. Maybe that's a little bit more me because maybe I'm a little bit, there may be some anxiety about what happens when you get acknowledged, that you still have to still remain with all the other things that you just said.
That's really interesting. Cause when you said that, I thought of, can you imagine being the Dalai Lama? The level of acknowledgement that happens, and you know how profound it must be to stay grounded in that energy field. In a way, it's the only, there's only two exits from that kind of level of acknowledgement, which is one is to return it, you know, with blessings, with concern and care for others. Then it circles through. It's beautiful, actually.
Yes.
And the other is to somehow understand egolessness, even in the middle of that level of acknowledgement, is really challenging. And the other option for you is to suck it in, and the whole thing becomes bloated and toxic. And we, in our industry, we see plenty of examples of that, right? People are not, they're stuck with their success. They're stuck with their accomplishment. You know, they're stuck with the acknowledgement. I was just reading, about an actor who was saying that, you know, he is, it was actually Elon Musk was saying, the interviewer said, what's it like for you, like, being so recognizable? And he said, well, I can't really go get a cup of coffee anymore or walk down the street or go to the store. And, you know, you and I both know people who probably couldn't do that either. And yet there's some, you know, powerful elixir there for people, and there's some powerful magnet in it. But we both know people who are miserable in the middle of that, which is ironic because it's what everybody else is thinking. Oh, they have success. So
don't you think also there are some people that have complete ownership of that toxicity? You know, they're like, you know who they are. I know a couple friends that really love that kind of relationship to fame and things like that.
And they're comfortable assuming that. But that's why we don't really have, at least, you know, I may be, you know, setting myself up here for all the famous Buddhist masters to say, what are you talking about here? It's egolessness and there's nothing. And, you know, you should just go into a cave and spit out the worldly dharmas as if they were toxic, you know, this toxic crap, basically. And also, more commonly, I've lived with, you know, people who are doing serious spiritual practice, but they withdraw from the worldly engagement. So an example would be one of my, you know, Sangha members, you know, 30, 40 years ago, she had a job and she said, I'm just doing this job so I can get money for my retreats together. And you miss that whole opportunity for the job itself to become Dharma and to become a growing and fertile area.
Wow.
So, you know, these days I think it's healthier because people are saying maybe that kind of specialty aspect of Dharma needs to be blended in with the kind of, and it is East meeting West in terms of, like, Western people are not renunciates in the same way, are we, for the most part? I don't know how much renunciate path is going to really take hold in the West, particularly the U.S.
When I told you I did sound effects editing, you know, there could have been a part of me that's like, well, I'm just doing sound effects editing so that, you know, until I get my composing gig. And I think relating to it that way would have been a missed opportunity. Because I learned a lot. I ended up bringing all my sound design skills from, like, you know, making lasers and, you know, evil backgrounds for planets. And I brought that into 24, you know, making unsettling textures and stuff. So, like, I think everything along the way is potentially fruitional, you know, but I'm meeting younger people that are so, their ambition and drive is so admired. But I think I just think sometimes there's such a drive and such an expectation that anything off that path, anything off that path is regarded as waste or distraction, or if it can't be converted into forward movement or something. And it's an interesting energy to work with. I'm not even really putting it down necessarily because I will say that when I first contacted it, it was a bit disorienting. But I'm in my late 50s now. So this is what's with us.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
If you're in your late 50s, I must be getting older.
No, you look cooler. The glasses.
Well, I did that because the skylight here is just blasting sunlight into my eyes. But
say, Colonel Kurtz over there. Like,
yeah. So, you know, that's another interesting thing where the wheel turns. You know, if you're on a Ferris wheel and you realize you're sort of like actually heading back towards the place where they punch the tickets, you go, didn't I start here? This is kind of interesting moment.
Metaphor.
And for people sometimes who are very fixated on their manifestation in the world, they begin to have a very hard time at that point because there's nothing, they can't grasp onto it any longer. So it gets more and more desperate. So
it's interesting,
do you think about death at all?
Yes, I and it happened, you know, it happened just yesterday. You get your physicals each year and stuff like that. And I got a call from an old high school friend who's very sick. And I grew up with the guy, and we're about the same age. And I'm 58, and my own brother died 7 years ago at 57. And when I hit my 57th year, I was looking over. I just had a little bit of paranoia about reaching the age that I didn't expect my older brother to pass. So mortality issues they've been a bit floating around.
Yeah.
And honestly, when my friend called me yesterday and told me he was ill, I really felt a bit of I felt a lot of fear.
Mm. Yeah, and that's good that you brought that up, because I pick up the threads from the atmosphere and the spontaneous. So I asked you right before we came on, you have a necklace on. Is that what you call it? A necklace? Is that what you call it?
It's a little thing with a Sanskrit word on it in the back. It translates into fearlessness.
And I asked you, what are you wearing? Because first thing I thought was this, St. Christopher or somebody like that from your past, but fearlessness. So I thought, well, it's such an interesting topic, fear and fearlessness. Why do you have that around your neck? Why are you centering my attention and awareness and everybody's on the fact that you have this connection with fearlessness?
Well, in my studies with Shambhala and Rinpoche, the teachings for me were about it is not about being without fear. It's actually being profoundly acquainted with fear. Mm-hmm. And it's being like to lean into, you can actually touch it and soak at it a little bit. You can really be very acquainted with it. And that being acquainted with it, fearless does not mean that I'm trying to get to a place where I'm without fear. I think I'm trying to say that, I'll give you an example. When I conducted for, a concert in the spring at UCLA, music from this TV series Halo, and then I also conducted on the recording stage for the score. Now, that there's a lot of money being spent per minute with people sitting in there.
Yeah,
and but that
the pressure's really on you at that point, right?
Yes, and there's some anxiety out there. There's some fear, and you can If you're afraid of feeling fear, you're going to work extraordinarily hard to build a house where you think you're going to put the fear in there, and it's just so much work rather than, okay, I am feeling some fear. I'm anxious. Mm-hmm. Let's just get with it. And then you kind of use your mind and say, well, have I done it before? Yes. Have I rehearsed it? Yes. Even if I hadn't done it before, can I get us started? Do I have everything? Yes. It's like silly putty. You can get a little bit more acquainted. You get acquainted with the fear. You can work with the fear, and on you move. You try not to make a federal case out of it.
But
I still feel a lot of it. I still feel a lot of fear.
But you could, that fear for many people can become a boundary, and they would just go like, I can't do this, and I'm backing out. And maybe we all limit ourselves by, in that way, in different areas of our lives, right? Where you just go, so what you're talking about is the sort of warrior path is to acknowledge the fear, recognize the energy bank that it is, not try to conquer it superficially, like you're saying, just like, kind of everything's cool,
I got this.
That kind of approach. But engaging it leads you to have experiences that are transformative and growth oriented, usually, don't you think?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I'm thinking of when I was learning how to. I haven't skied in several years, but they have the green circles and the blue squares and the black diamond slopes. Well, sometimes when you're younger, they're like, "Oh, you're scared. Go down the black diamond slope." Well, you'll be like, you might say, "Oh, I'm afraid to go down the black diamond slope," and you made a wise decision not going down the black diamond slope because you don't have the training, So there's a little bit of the situational things that you can say, hey, I'm afraid, I'm not going down it. And guess what? That's the right call. I might, but for me, but if you're going up to conduct and you've done it 30 years or 20 years and you say, I can't go out there and conduct. You go like, hold on, you know, you can really get into it with your mind and, mm-hmm. and you know, mm-hmm. But absolutely, you know, those experiences are, they're juicy, as you say, they're very juicy and sometimes they're extraordinarily unpleasant.
So, you know, just since we're sort of in a little bit of a Dharma area here, I use I use two kinds of analogies really a lot. One is music because I'm so familiar with it, the area. Mm-hmm. And the other mm-hmm. is sports. Now, mm-hmm. I look at people's faces. I go, are we together on this? Because I'm using a metaphor here. And as you know, as a meditation teacher, a good metaphor is like, you know, almost like a good song title is in Nashville. You know, people steal Absolutely. Them. You know, we use Pema Chodron's Gentleness, Precision, and Letting Go as one chapter out of one of her books as a sort of core premise for our whole training program.
Right.
So in this case, I use the metaphor, and I think this is something that as people are learning about mindfulness meditation is coming more and more up, that there's two parts to it. And one part is the ability to focus onto a single point, you know, which is shine in Tibetan or shamatha in Sanskrit, you know, just mm-hmm. that developing that focus. The other is developing an awareness of the non-judgmental awareness of the whole situation, which is really Vipassana more. So I use the analogy of you're up there conducting the orchestra. It's time for the timpani entrance. You got to be right on point. You got to know exactly what bar you're at, where the timpani player is, mm-hmm. and your mind for 1 second is on that. And then you still can't lose your awareness of what the full orchestra is doing. And so you have to merge focus and awareness in terms of conducting orchestra. Do you think that's a reasonable metaphor?
Very reasonable. I think that's a really, because, you know, a symphony, even if you step up to do Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, it'll never be performed the same way twice. Never. You know, there's millions and infinitesimal little things that are going on with all the human beings playing it, you know?
Wow.
So when you're, you know, I mean, you can listen to a recording, yeah. but when you go hear it live, it'll never be, ever be the same thing. It's human beings that are bringing it all together, and it's all happening in an interactive, wonderful, magical way. You
know, that's one of the best definitions of impermanence, which we struggle to explain that. But what people have misunderstood, I think, about impermanence is, oh, it's just a nullifying and a void and nothing, you know, nothing exists. So, you know, and also emptiness. But what we're saying is there's this rich symphony going on mm-hmm. and there is a pattern to it, but it'll never be the same from one time to one time. And that's true of every moment of your life.
Yeah. And by the way, I've scored a lot of scenes of like people running down hallway with guns and stuff.
Yeah.
And
oh, okay.
you can get a little, they sometimes put in temp music and they'll put in temp music from another film or something of mine mm-hmm, even. They're mm-hmm. like, God, we really love this. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you know, okay. And you really do want to show up for that moment, you know, and make that unique and, mm-hmm. and so forth. So it's from the point of view of writing original music, that opportunity presents itself so regularly because it really is about touching and letting go. You're taking in a moment, you're letting go, you're coming back, you're leading. Mm. It's that back and forth process is absolutely, I hadn't really quite articulated that until we started studying together, that that letting go and so forth. But yeah, but the every single piece of music I've ever heard over and over again is different every time. You know how you get attached to, sometimes we get attached to certain performances, like, oh, you got to hear Bernstein's Rite of Spring. You know, that's the last one. You get kind of attached to literally the, you know, that, you know, but then you go hear it live and it's a whole nother thing, you know.
Yeah.
Even though it's the same piece.
Ooh. And then Beethoven himself is gone.
Yeah.
That's a sort of interesting, you know, as people who create something that could outlive us, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, when you're doing that, creating something that you want to have a life beyond your own life, you mm-hmm. know, and that you won't be able to grasp at it. You won't be able to get the acknowledgement. You'll be dead.
Case, let me ask you a question. This is a question someone asked me the other day. You look at a Picasso, right? You know, it's you, your eyes, and the artwork, right? You know, that experience is a singular, you know, there's a pathway there in terms of how you're taking it in. If you're listening, when you take in Beethoven, does it not require the interface of other human beings to experience it? In other words, he was sort of challenging my view of how we take in take in art, and to take in any music of Beethoven, we can look at notes, but we really can't do much with looking at a manuscript. It really has to be interpreted by a human being living now, you know, I found it to be interesting because we don't need that kind of translator looking at irises, for example, you know.
Well, there's two things that come to mind on that. Is one is, you know, we asked Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, who was my teacher, and you know, when we were talking about success, I think the assignment he had is you have to transplant Tibetan Buddhism in the West. Mm-hmm. Good luck. We'll see you on the other side. I mean, when I contemplate what he did in his lifetime and kind of, it's really, if you just look at the outcome, he's been dead for 35 years.
Yeah.
The outcome is stunning in terms of the, you know, what it generated. But we asked him, you know, what do you hear when you listen to music?
Yeah.
And you know what he said? Guess what he said?
I know because
I've told you this already.
You told me, but I refer to this very often.
Yeah? Okay, so what is it?
He goes, he hears the mind of the composer.
So he's hearing right through the performance.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because there is something about the Beethoven that's the same every time too.
It is.
There's a primordial kind of basic thing that is unchanging aspect of it. So that, you know, I think this is a good conversation for Buddhists to have, is understanding that emptiness is not a flattening out and an emptying out of the content of our lives and the relative truth. So we talk about, you know, all the time, absolute and relative truth.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
The other thing that leads to asking you is, what of what you're doing now would you like to outlive you?
You know,
and so this is sort of an interesting, you know, interesting. I mean, I'm just coming up with it right now, but we haven't really talked about that.
I mean, of course, it'd be lovely if in 100 years, if someone were to call up an episode of something and hear something that resonated, I would be, that'd be kind of cool. I mean, I think that would be kind of cool if a piece of me survived. And I'm not trying to put myself down when I say this. I don't know if I've written anything that's going to be heard in 100 years. I hope something is. You know, there's a few things that I feel more attached to than others that I think meant a lot to me. Oddly, really strange little things, little scenes that kind of just survive and make me happy, you know. But what I love when I read about, I love when, you know, Beethoven was one of the, we go back to Beethoven, a lot was written about Beethoven's state of mind, that he struggled quite a bit. And composers before Beethoven, not as much. I've always been fascinated at the way composers, you know, how they did what they did and still lived, you know. And so,
what did he struggle with?
Oh, well, he had, well, obviously he had hearing issues, but he had issues about, he wrote a lot of letters about how he was struggling just with certain depressions and so forth, certain things. He was in love with, there was a movie called Immortal Beloved, which was, it is theorized that he was in love with someone that didn't return his affections and so forth. But he wrote a lot of letters that talked about his state of mind at the time, and some of it was challenging. He just had some, what it showed me is he was a guy. He was a dude. He was a guy who had troubles here and there, you know? And, I don't know. I'd like it if someone read something about me and said, oh, he was, this person was try to be kind. He tried to be, you know, wouldn't that be, yeah. I'd like that to survive. That, someone wrote something nice about me who I hired a few years ago, who said I was a really nice person to work for. He said that on and that actually meant more to me than a lot, it meant quite a bit. Not because I want to be stroked, but just because you just want to be, you just would like to, you just, how do you say it feels good to do that without sounding like it's too much of a made for TV film? You know what I mean? It's made for TV Hallmark movie or something.
Well, that's what's so funny about the things that become, you know, commercialized or cliched. A lot of them are based on, you know, a Hallmark greeting card is based on some of actually original sentiment that is genuine.
So, and, why, you know, so what got screwed up then? You know, too much of it?
From our perspective, maybe a kind of wishful thinking as opposed to a real path, you know, towards actually manifesting that. But, you know, I just watched a film. I'll send you the link to it about a teacher named Garchen Rinpoche, who was in Chinese prison camps for 20 years and came out of it. I'll send you the link, and maybe we can, Michael can put it into the link in the podcast for people who want to check it out to see what somebody who is leaving a wake of kindness and compassion and overcoming a lot of obstacles to manifest that, and with a kind of confidence and commitment to it that is not based on wishful thinking. It's based on real heart and connection, which includes the suffering you're talking about. It doesn't try to bypass that. That's the difference, I think, is if something's trying to bypass the suffering that Beethoven experienced and go, you know, let's just play a happy song, you know. You know that joke, what do you get when you play New Age music backwards?
New Age music? What is it?
Yes. You know, there's not enough definition. There's not enough journey. There's not, you know, I mean, and please, anybody out there who's making, quote unquote, is in the New Age band, I know that's not your objective.
No.
Yeah, but you know what you get when you play country music backwards, right?
Oh, tell me again. What is it?
You get your house back. You get your car back. You get your wife back. You get sober. So,
you know what I think? You know what I think it is, man? You know, as you talk about it, you know, the New Age joke is because I think there's some, you know, there's some New Age music that, if we go back to the very first part of our conversation, the authenticity, the point of view, that you know, where you're coming from when it's happening.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that's landing. But the things that we joke about are the things that are landing with such, they're kind of specious and toothless, you know, kind of, and they don't kind of stand the test of time.
A good title for a New Age album, Specious and Toothless. Or the name of a band, you know. Yeah, I mean, I hope everybody understands that we're kidding around here a bit.
We are totally kidding.
And any genre can have its richness. But what we're really talking about is teeth, you know, and the truth, recognizing the truth of suffering at a relative level and not bypassing it. That's what we're really talking about in terms of both art and spiritual development.
Do you have a film that you watched that comes to mind when you heard the music, or anything that was just so perfect, like that so pierced you when you saw it the first time, you know, anything that comes through, you know, in terms of whether it was the music or the whole thing that just sort of, because everyone has something that just sort of,
yeah,
just so hits you so authentically and so real. Can you know what it is?
It's so funny that you're asking me that, because I had that thought while we were talking about it. You know, a lot of first thoughts are sparking from our conversations, but there was a musician that I had the privilege, I'm going to say, to work with, named Ustad Sultan Khan. And Sultan Khan was a classical Indian musician, but he did also play with the Beatles and some Western artists and so forth. He played sarangi, which is a kind of bowed instrument, which sounds like the human voice on steroids. You know, it has all the compelling quality of the human voice. Mm-hmm. And there's such interesting things about that I got to be with somebody like that and make music with somebody like that. I consider my life completely blessed in that way, that I've had so many occasions to meet people like that and exchange with them. But when he was introduced to me by two friends who were on my record label at the time, which was also called Dharma Moon at the time, and Falu Shah and her wife Gaurav, who's, you know, part of the community that we're you know, taking sometimes meditation classes and so forth. And Falu was, whose name was Falguni at the time, Falguni Shah, was one of his best students. Mm. So they brought him to up to our studio, and I met him, and he had this enormous voltage, you know, walking into the room. They introduced him to Anna, who was in our office at the time, and it was her birthday, and he just took out $200 cash and just gave it to her. He just got off the elevator. He just had this kind of scope and depth. And then we went to hear him play at probably Town Hall or Carnegie Hall or someplace like that. And he played one note. And I felt like somebody had stabbed me in the heart. That would be if you said, well, what did you experience? I said, I experienced somebody stabbing me in the heart. And you could see in that context, you know, when we went backstage, you know, this is his guru. This is Falu and Gaurav's guru. So they go backstage, they touch their head to the person's feet, which in the West you go, oh, that's just whatever, you know, that's horrible. And in a million times I would do that without even thinking about it, because this person had generated such a powerful egoless field of pure heart and pure feeling. So I would say Indian music can really do that to me sometimes, you know, but particularly him. What were you thinking of? Did you think of a piece of music or a show or something?
Well, I mean, from the musical point of view, the first time I ever heard, I didn't hear Stravinsky till I was much older. I was grew up in a small New England town. So when I first heard The Rite of Spring performed, which is, you know, na, 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 I was like, what's happening? Like what's happening here? You know, and it almost makes me emotional when you talked about that first note, because I mean, you really do. There's something so, to quote our work together, you know, there's something so before thought when that happens. You know, when you're getting it, it's so, and that's what really I try to do with the work that I do is that kind of thing. You know, and it's just, it's extraordinary when it happens. Now, from a cinematic point of view, I mean, this is just a little boy thing, but I saw Jaws when I was 11 years old. That was the shark movie. And now it's been done over and over again and so forth. But if you could really understand what it was like, or I'll even do one better, the opening 2 minutes of Star Wars. I mean, that was just a, you know.
The first one before all the sequels.
Before everything. I mean, the very first thing and the score and so forth. And so those are the moments that you kind of realize, wow, I really, this is a part of my life that I want to pursue. You know, you kind of realize something on the spot. You know, how does this happen? How does music do that?
You know, well, and you're completely in the business and the art form of saying, look at what just happened. Here's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So here's the shark in Jaws, right?
Yeah.
And who composed the score for Jaws?
John Williams.
God, he's an important person for you, because you mentioned Star Wars too. Didn't he do the score for Star Wars also?
He did. We have the same agent actually. So I've had the rare occasion of being able to meet him a couple times, which is sort of like meeting a. I don't know. It's like meeting an idol, and you have to kind of. But he's a human being who, 90 years old, and he's does his thing, and you know,
is he composing to the right now?
To this day, he just finished Indiana Jones 5. He just
and he's 90.
He's 90.
Listen up, everybody! All you more, you know, kind of downheaded people. I'm getting so old. You know, take care of yourselves, and you'll be doing that too. And
absolutely.
You know, that's inspiring. But you have to raise your wind horse. You have to want to even live that long. I think a lot of people die because they don't even really want to live that long. They're tired. You know, I've experienced this myself personally. Like you go, I think I'll pass. I've had enough. You know, take a rest. But we have other influences, don't we? Yeah.
Yeah. If anything, when I just learned of my other friend's illness, boy, I said, you say to yourself, man, it's great to be alive. Like it is fucking great. Excuse my language, but it is like, you're like, cause I got the results of my physical and I'm, you know, knock wood. I'm all okay. You know, but I'm like, you know, let's just take a moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not really, it kind of stops the conversation, doesn't it?
Well, and the flip side of it is there was one of our lineage teachers named Kenpo Sultrum Gyatso, who's a very important teacher in the Kagyu lineage, but a yogi, He has no home. He's, you know, he really, really is living like Milarepa or somebody like that, you know. And he, for example, he had an exchange with one of the students who was in prison, you know, and was doing his practice in prison. And he asked him, Rinpoche, what should I do with the obstacle of being in prison? And Rinpoche, Sultan Gyamso said to him, what obstacle?
Wow.
So there's that kind of cutting edge view. And I asked him, there's a famous story. I asked him, which my son Ethan has sort of immortalized in one of his books. It's right in the first paragraph. We had an exchange. He stayed at my house in New York. And I, through the translator, I said, could you ask Rinpoche where he lives? And through the translator, he said, Rinpoche said to tell you he lives in the center of his awareness. And I said, you can guess what I said next, right? Is that anywhere near 38th Street and 2nd Avenue?
What's the zip code? Yeah, is that an Uber? Can I put that in my GPS? I will say, you know, for what it's worth, you know, one thing that I probably carried, one thing that happens is when we're talking about creativity, spirituality, making a buck, the success is an interesting thing because sometimes you can, I remember sometimes getting very preoccupied sometimes by the horse race of others, how they were doing, my contemporaries, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that is a real interesting, because it's a natural thing. Leaning into that and really getting to that essence for me has been a really great, at least a very informative part of the journey, because I love it when it doesn't pop up, you know, it doesn't, right. You know, when you, because it's really taking, you're like, why are you like, I don't even know what the essence, you know, is it jealousy, envy, whatever. It has to be something that it's an unpleasant feeling, but that's sort of like what we're talking about with fearlessness, the idea of leaning into unpleasant things along your journey. That's something that's like, look, there are some people that said to me once in an interview, hey, you haven't done many movies. I said, that's true. I stayed more in TV. Well, why haven't you done movies? Well, I'd love to do some more movies, you know, but I have but in terms of what I've been able to do musically in with what I've done the last 25 years, I feel very grateful and very happy with the work that I've done.
Yeah.
So it's there's a relationship. There's a relationship to that that's always being reevaluated. You know, are you looking for is this something you really want? You know,
yeah.
That's one thing I was really asking.
Well, would you like to do films?
I did one at the beginning of the pandemic with Liam Neeson. It was called The Marksman, and it was great because it was wider. It, you know, it was filmed more cinematically. It had more exposition time for exposition and so forth.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful experience. Just wonderful. Just another experience. But
did you meet him?
I didn't, but I heard he liked the score.
Felt good. I mean, he's like, you know, an icon.
He's from Schindler's List to Woody Allen movies to his career in Taken. I mean, he's phenomenal in the movie. Phenomenal.
Yeah. Shout out.
He gives you so much. He gives you, I mean, as a composer, when you get that kind of info, it's great. Mm. You know.
And what are you working on now? Is there anything cool that you want to share?
This is Western Thursdays on the CW, and I think it's on Amazon the next day or Hulu. It's called Walker Independence. It's a Western set in the 1800s. It's a fun show. There's actually a song and dance number I had to write for a saloon that's airing next Thursday. Which
it's a series? The show is a series.
Yeah.
So are you
and then the next,
doing that now, right now? Are you
right now.
Oh, wow.
Right now. Okay. And then the next one is... God, I'm so sorry. I had a little frog. Is The Accused. There's a law drama called The Accused that's coming out in January. It's 12 anthological stories, or 15 actually, 15 episodes. Anthological stories. Each one is a standalone story about a really, really, you know, touchy sweet spot of law and society and a set of stories, whether it's one episode's, well, I guess I can't really talk about, but each one is really just, they're just really superbly shot, and they're great stories, and each one is its own standalone. So that's actually quite interesting.
And so on Fox.
Yeah,
that's you know, because so many people are behind the scenes, quote unquote, doing the work that people really. Let's face it, this culture, our television, our film, is a huge part of our culture, and it's not just the people who are in the front who are creating that. And, you know, if anybody's here has the opportunity to watch a movie or a TV show without the music, with the dialing login and no music, you're going to have an experience that we take the music for granted, because to some extent scoring, you want to blend in. You don't want to like stick out so much, right? And if the emotion carries the scene and somebody doesn't go, oh, that was a great orchestration or something like that, it's better in a way, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a movie once I was watching, and my wife Deb turned to me. She goes, I don't like this. This music isn't working. Like when someone says the music is standing out, or right. then there's a problem, you know. Mm. Or if the music gets, if you can't hear the dialogue,
yeah,
nobody's getting their meal. You know, nobody. It's just there's things like that. But there's all kinds. There's art directors that are the ones responsible for making sure the hotel doors are of the right time period, and you know, and the design of the room is, you know, it's like a couple hundred people,
right,
that gets the image put together, and they're from all walks of life.
Wow.
They have to all work together. It's crazy, and it's privileged to be a part of it. And I'm in the caboose. I'm in the post production part.
Yeah, the caboose. Now, you would have the capacity. The podcast is a little bit free form, and we haven't done exactly this before, but I know that you could roll over to your piano right there. And if we said, what was the scene you were talking about earlier? Like sad, somebody's sad or.
Yeah. Honestly, if you took a public domain song, like, oh, hang on.
No. Don't do it. Do something original, because I don't want to get involved with copyright stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But so, if you could, and you have, did you turn your original sound on?
Yeah, I will. Yeah.
Yeah, so that we really hear it. But like, if you could just show right on the spot what it's like to change a narrative, an experience, an emotional experience, and just flip that switch and turn it into music. Do you feel comfortable taking a shot at doing something like that on the spot?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how you can hear it. But like, sometimes someone director will say, you know, there's some shock. Like, what are you feeling when you're seeing a person looking over the body of a relative that just got shot dead? You know, what is that? Is it like you heard in the? Oh,
it's empty. It's
nothing. Nothing happened. Oh, that's so funny. I don't think it's good. Oh, if it's, I don't know why it's not working. Hang on, let me see. That's so funny. Oh, there we go. Oh. There we go.
Yeah.
You know, is it like, you know? Is it, you know? Is it a shocking? You know, that's sort of an aggressive.
Right.
You know. The things that conjured to my mind is she's alone. Now she's alone. Okay. So you wouldn't be, you know, that's too thin. You know? I mean, that you know, you'd be. Yeah,
bring the volume down just a hair.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, that's good.
So then I, you know, the idea is it's more of a delicate, you know, what I'm trying to just imagine it just be like. You're just letting it just wandering, you know.
But the feeling comes through so, you know, if a picture's worth 1,000 words, a song is worth at least 500, don't you think?
Yes. But sometimes someone will say to you, well, that's really great, but it, you know, could we, I want to feel more the heaviness. You know, sometimes a person will say, I want to feel more of the heaviness. So you want to take what's coming for you organically, but if you want to meet the needs of someone who has a creative need, then they're explaining it to you, you know, maybe it's a, you know. Taking the heaviness, you know, a little bit of the brooding You know, again, it's just an idea, but I'm still trying to keep her, I'm trying to keep this person in her own little, you know, and that little part of you that's weaving that little inspiration, that little seed.
Yeah.
A smart producer will understand, he'll hear your heart in it, you know.
Right,
and
right.
But if he's all closed off and just wants to be the control freak, no, get rid of that high note. Fine.
Right.
And then you have to be okay with that, you know.
That was so great. I mean, you know, there's a translation process of, the energy. We call it the Sambhogakaya in Vajrayana Buddhism, you know, the energy realm, which is expressed in color, in sound, deities, you know, and things. And I think people would make a big mistake if they thought, oh, this is another world that we're portraying that is other than this world. But it's a symbolic rendering of this world at the level of the energies that are experienced. So in 1 minute, you had somebody starting to feel, what does it feel like to be alone?
Yeah.
You know, and you didn't fill it up. What I loved about what you just did is you didn't fill it up.
Right.
Because that would have been, you know, kind of, you know, you could have just shown off a little bit there, but you left this space because there's the shock and there's the space. So,
Yes, you got it. You got it. I mean, but you know, I didn't, before I sat down to do it, I didn't say, okay, I'm going to do this and let some space happen. You know, in other words, you just released into it. It's that you just had to release into it. So yeah, that's it, man.
Yeah. Let the feeling come through you.
Yeah.
And because you have the skill set to translate that into music or poetry or some, you know, art form, then other people can feel it through you, you know.
So, nailed it. I have to say one thing to you, and this is a totally LA thing.
Yeah.
I actually have to play a saloon piece of music for one of the upcoming episodes, and the director and the line, the art, they have to talk to me about it in about 3 minutes.
Perfect.
And so I think
it's perfect.
So I wish we could. And then maybe I'll give you the update. I'll tell you how it went. But they're going to tell, an actress comes in. She has to play it. And the actress, this is how cool it is. The actress knows how to play a little piano. So she actually requested an overhead shot of me playing it so that she could look as accurate as possible. So when you have people that want to be that precise with their work, it makes you sit up straighter with your work, you know? So this is really kind of cool.
How great to have you on, you know, you know, have so many points of communication between us that it's such a rich friendship. And I want to thank you so much, Sean, for coming
on. Listen, you didn't ask me to do this, but you know, when we started working together in the training, and then we did these, you said, send me a little text when you do the meditation, the 20-minute videos. We did these little videos of me. I said, look, I sat today and so forth. Anyway, I think you're going to show a couple of them, but that was so much fun to take what was sometimes a very complicated or annoying thing to do, but then to make something interesting out of it. And I love our friendship, and I love studying with you, and I love all the adventures that are still to come. So
great.
That's all
I can
say.
And we'll share some of those because they're really lighthearted and fun. But have a great meeting.
Thank you.
And of course, we'll talk soon. So
I look forward to it. Yeah, I will reach out to you. Yes, thank you.
And we'll put some references on the know, with the podcast of things that you're doing now or anything that you want to share with people.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Okay.
Bye, David. Take care, everybody. See, bye.
Bye. Bye-bye, Sean.
Okay, everybody, there you have it. Episode number 43 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with Sean Callery on the Be Here Now Network. We would like to send a huge thank you out to Sean for taking part and joining us in the podcast. I really enjoyed that episode, and we hope that you all did too. That last part was great. I almost wish the whole episode was just them coming up with various scenarios and Sean playing the piano. And I really appreciate the little tantric moment at the end with some Sambhogakaya talk, which is one of my favorite topics as a fellow Sambhogakayist with David and Sean. So welcome to almost the end. So after this brief exposition here, post-position, we're going to share some of those Nuji Challenge videos on the YouTube. So if you're listening on the podcast, head over to Be Here Now's YouTube page and give a watch to Sean's work around the Nuji Challenge. But Firstly, the important business is we have to send a huge thank you out to Be Here Now Network and encourage everyone to head over to their webpage. So let's see. I'm going to go to my my earlier written part. Here we go. This podcast would not be streaming into your mind stream if it were not for the Be Here Now Network and their amazing staff of dedicated humans. Big thanks to everyone at Be Here Now. We encourage everyone to head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com/David to hear more of this podcast if you like it. And if you are still listening, I assume you enjoy it. Also, drop the /David from the URL and enjoy the feast of podcasts from our world's wisdom traditions. This is all a part of Baba Ram Dass's legacy and a continuation of his life's work done lovingly by his Sangha and community, and we all benefit from it. So deep gratitude to everyone at Be Here Now. Okay, also head over to dharmamoon.com to check out our upcoming programming. And if you are a CSM person, head over to New York Insights webpage, nyimc.org, and find the upcoming Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck workshop. Okay, that's it for me. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like this podcast, please share it. Give us a positive review, 11 stars, all the things on your listening platform. Tell your friends. And thank you for watching. May you be safe, healthy, happy, and at ease. And without further ado, here is the world premiere, Day 20, What My Mind Is Doing, by Sean Callery for the Nudgee Challenge. And next, we have Day 41, Non-Dual, by Sean Callery. And next, one of my favorite, Mind Boogers, a David Nicktern song by Sean Callery.
The wheel of life is the blueprint for mind boogers. The wheel of life is the blueprint for mind boogers. It starts as mucus in your nose, but then it gets hard like a garden hose. Blueprint for mind boogers. The wheel of life is the blueprint for mind boogers. Thinking.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.